If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12-powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to Kartik Kumar of Artemis, one of the UK's finest global investors. So welcome, Kartik.
Morning.
Well, you've had really a sort of two-speed stock market this year, a bit of a bifurcation between strength out in the US in tech land and weakness largely in the sort of like the healthcare or energy or consumer, even in the sort of house builders. And also we've seen it on a regional basis, UK significantly underperforming the American sort of counterparts. And we've had a sort of like, again, a difference between small and large caps. So putting all that together, what's your sort of outlook for equities? Are we going to see a sort of like a mean reversion trade?
I think the first observation to make is that it has really been quite hard going in the UK, particularly in the domestically focused market. So I was having a look at some of these numbers, but if you looked in real terms, which I think you need to do when inflation increases significantly as it has, the FTSE 250 is down 30% in real terms from the end of 2019, so just prior to COVID. And so if you think about that 30% decline in real terms, that's really quite a significant fall. Whereas I think if you looked at it in nominal terms, it doesn't look quite so bad. And also because it's been such a slow grind down, I think this is the point Richard Buxton made in Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago, is a grinding down bear market is much harder to handle because you can sort of lose your nerve than one where you wake up one morning and, you know, I think you made the comparison to 1987 when, you know, you wake up and stocks are 30% lower. You don't actually have time to panic, and it always, you know, you can react pretty aggressively. So in the domestic market, share price declined really quite significant. Valuations are pretty low. The way I like to look at this from a sort of framework perspective is I like to look at equity risk premium. And why do I do that? Is because really, I think you've got to think about it as your alternative being, you're trying to protect your wealth and grow it in real terms. Your alternative is risk-free government bonds that are inflation linked. In the UK, those currently yield 0.7%. I think that might, you know, I think that's slightly surprising in some ways that real yielding bonds haven't actually increased so much. I think some people probably weren't aware of how negative the real yields were. In the US, they're 2%. But if you look at the FTSE All Share, its earnings yield, which is, I think, the yield you have to look at, or the dividend yield, is about 10. So 10 minus 1, or let's round up to 1, you should be receiving about a 9% premium for investing in equities versus your risk-free alternative. If you looked historically, when rates were 5% back in the 90s, that equity risk premium was 5%. So I think fairly objective. In fact, it is objective to say that equity risk premium in the UK is elevated. Whether that's justifiable or not is a different debate, because you've come onto factors such as the UK having high weightings in banks, energy, and commodities. Those are, I think, undeniably sort of higher risk segments than, I don't know, Google and Microsoft, albeit sort of depends on the price, I would think. But no, the earnings must be, I think, riskier. And so if you combine those factors, yeah, I think the UK market looks very compelling. I would have said that at any point for the last 5 years, and therefore I don't understand why you would want to stop listening to me, but that's strongly what I think. Square, I think it's very attractive. I invest my own money in the fund. And I think at some point, when this reverts, it'll be pretty violent, I would think. I just make one other observation. I read a really good book the other day called What I Learned from Darwin About Investing. And one of the best slides I thought it had was, and you know, fortunately, he's an investor in India. He's had a lot of 10 baggers in the last 6 years. I haven't had very many. He looked at actually the price appreciation, the number, effectively stocks rise and fall 50% of the time. Any day tomorrow, probability of stocks rising and falling is actually probably 50-50. And less than 2% of trading days accounted for over 100% of your gains. Now, this is probably why a wealth manager tells any pensioner why time in the market's more than timing the market. But I would say I increasingly subscribe to that, and that's why I wouldn't try and predict when or when it happens. But I strongly think that the UK market is called spring. Whether it's CPI that does or doesn't do it, or what it is, I suspect those lumpy positive gains are ahead, not behind.
Mm. And then just in terms of sort of like an indication that it is undervalued, I guess there has been quite a bit of sort of like stock buybacks, hasn't there, by companies? And likewise with M&A, sort of like private equity and trade buyers taking stocks off the actual the listed market. Give us just your thoughts on that. Is that a positive indicator that if, you know, the sensible, the professional money is seeing value in the UK, and it's a matter of sort of hopefully time before, you know, the actual proper sort of like fund, well, the market starts realizing it?
On the point of stock buybacks, yes, I'd agree with that. It just in simple terms, if a market is cheap and companies are buying back the stock, the longer it stays cheap for, the larger your potential return will be in the future. That's a mathematical equation. I wouldn't want to overemphasize it for the one reason that, you know, you didn't see many stock buybacks in 2020. You know, I mean, we even had the ludicrous situation where banks had to reverse their dividends that they accrued for. So, you know, if you look at sectors that are buying back stock in the UK, some of those are cyclical. And therefore, there's a chance that in the next downturn, you won't have them. Cyclical sectors tend to do pro-cyclical buybacks. However, I would make the general observation that, yes, I think it is reflective of the fact that we're not in a crisis and we've got valuations that are crisis-like. Mm. And you have companies that have good balance sheets and they can allocate their capital towards buybacks. So, you know, a good example would be NatWest. You know, if you woke up, if you're an alien and you landed in St. James's, and you saw that rates had gone from, call it 1 to 5, and NatWest share price was down over 5 years, and its net interest income had risen a lot, and it derated from, call it 9 times earnings to 4. You would think that there's some sort of impending disaster, be it Apple about to become the largest consumer bank in the UK or a mortgage crisis. But that's not the reality. The reality is you have very sort of cheap stocks are very cheap right now. Pretty extraordinarily so, and we're not in a crisis. And that's why, yeah, I think even with M&A, you're seeing it on a corporate basis, you're seeing it some from PE, I mean, far less so than in priors, but that reflects the cost of debt and the instability in debt markets.
Mm. And then just in terms of sort of NatWest, and I think you had another one, which is Lloyds, the other sort of big, well, one big mortgage provider in the UK. And obviously NatWest is a more business type of bank. But they both trade at significant discounts to net book. How much sort of like upside do you see in them? Because obviously the market is a bit worrying in terms of the its quality of its loan book, but also if it's got any sort of like hidden... sort of like, you know, bombs or the unexploded ordnance in its balance sheet somewhere.
Okay, so maybe I'll say two things: how I think about upside, and then how I think about the potential upside of banks. I think the first point to make is the investment process that we employ in Answer South and I, or more broadly, calls for you to try and think about the long-term potential return on the stock. Now, some people would point out that in the extremely long term, call it 30, 40 years or more, it converges to the return on capital in the business. In the shorter term, largely there's this equation, which effectively is it's a function of the price you pay for it, so the multiple, where it starts, where it ends, the earnings it'll generate, and then the capital efficiency of those earnings. So if you can grow without having to reinvest very much, you can pay it back to shareholders. And so if you look at something like NatWest today and it's on 5 times earnings, you can come up with a view on what earnings do over the next 5 years, which is, you know, to an extent influenced by interest rates, but really is quite stable because networks of Lloyds and retail deposit franchises that are in the business of having transactional deposits on the one side, mortgages on the other side, largely, and a big wedge of capital in the middle protecting them from losses. And so if you look at that today, the return that they generate on that is about 13-14%. I'll come back to this point later, but they've got this hedge book, which is skewing the results today. But you know, these are businesses which, taken NatWest's case, is probably going to distribute to you 15% per year. So if I assume that NatWest traded at 5x earning in five years' time, I should be making 15% per annum, probably. On top of that, I actually believe, if you think about intuitively, what is the right multiple for NatWest? Is it 5x earnings? I would argue not, because that's indicating a cost of equity of 15%. As we just discovered, my risk-free alternative is yielding 0.6. And I'll make this up just purely for illustrative purposes, but let's say you assume NatWest traded on 10x earnings in 5 years. Well, that's a doubling over 5 years, call it 15%. You're making 15% from the capital return. Broadly speaking, you'd be coming to an internal rate of return approximating 30%, which sounds extraordinary. And I did write an article, which is, you know, probably 20% offside now, is why I'd rather have my money in a NatWest, in the NatWest bank stock than in the NatWest account, which is giving me 5. And it's this broader point of bank accounts look alluring at the wrong time, is one that Warren Buffett made, is, you know, because actually then when interest rates come down, you want the duration that you get in stocks. So that's my broad framework, because in case we talk about anything else, I'll do it in the same way, whether it's Google or a house builder. But that's why I see the potential return in banks as being very high. It's a function of the starting distribution yield that you get from them. They are quite high return on capital businesses. So let's say we take your point, they're trading at a bit below book, and sustainable returns look in the range of 14 to 15%. So let's say I was to never sell my NatWest shares. I think my son would probably be making, you know, something in the region of 12 to 15%. But yeah, in my judgment, he'd have front-loaded returns, because at some point, I think the stock wouldn't be trading at 5x. But that's eroded it over, you know, over a 30-year period of changing multiple 5 to 10 actually doesn't make a big difference. There's one other observation I make to you on the UK banks. So I run a couple of funds, so I invest in European banks as well. And the UK banks really have been very poor. Partly that's a function of this sort of, you know, doom and malaise that you have in the UK. I was in a meeting with the European bank CEO, and he said to me, you do realize that this cost of living crisis term is a UK construct. We don't discuss that here in Europe. So, you know, you can read the papers. It's all quite grim. You can look at UK consumer confidence. It's quite low. You have the government sort of trying to, whether they'll do it or not, but in theory, talking about regulating excess returns, even though 13% doesn't strike me as a particularly egregious return. But the important point is UK banks hedge their part of their assets. So both Lloyds and NatWest have about 250 billion of assets. It's about that number around. They currently yield 1.3%. And then usually they invest in the five-year swap rate, which is currently at 4. So you can imagine, let's say rates fell to 3, not 4. You know, five-year swap rate is currently above 4. You would have 250 billion of assets that are repricing from 1.2 to, let's call it 3. That's 2%. That's extra 5 billion. There are some headwinds, but let's simplify and ignore those for a second, because actually the spot rate's above that. That's 5 billion. Lloyds' pre-tax profits are 7 billion today. So you could easily see how in that case that actually what it really is that you haven't seen the full benefit of the repricing of interest rates in the company's earnings yet, but it's kind of like a demographic. The longer this goes on, it will come through the numbers. So I think they're attractive assets. You know, in my opinion, it's not interest rates. It's the question of, could Apple become the leading, you know, could Apple become a leading deposit taker in the UK because it's enabled by technology and it's got a fantastic brand? That's, in my opinion, your long-term risk in Lloyds and would mean that you've got risk on 5x earnings.
Okay. All right. Well, let's pivot over to the States in the sort of megatech, mega tech area. Let's go to Google, because obviously it's been in the crosshairs of everything AI. Initially, when Microsoft and ChatGPT sort of launched together, then people were saying, that Google had fumbled the ball with its Bard AI chatbot assistant. But even so, the shares have actually done surprisingly well, and factually, Meta has done well. But let's start off with Google. What's your sort of latest view on Google? I mean, it's a huge business, and it's trading on roughly around, I think it's about 20 times when I looked at it.
Yeah, okay. So just a bit of context here for someone who looks at this and might think, why does a UK investment trust that's benchmarked against that's your threat have Google? Google's a top 10 position for us. We bought it in December and January last year. We also hold a position in Meta together, they're 5% of assets. We've held Meta on and off for 5 years. We've done very well from it. Starting with Google, why? Let me explain. So we invest up to 30% of our capital overseas. The way I like to describe it is we'll go overseas for a business that we can't find in the UK where we can employ our process. I think Google's quite an easy one for that, because it's just so obviously, Yellow Pages isn't left anymore. So there's nothing quite like it. And what's attractive about it? So, I've been reading about AI for a while. In my opinion, a general distinction I would make is if you look at the Clayton Christensen way of categorizing technologies, he puts them into two buckets of disruptive and enabling. I think it's much more likely that AI is, on the whole, an enabling technology, unlike the internet, which was really quite disruptive because it rewrote all sorts of forms of distribution, be it in music, be it in e-commerce, and with the fixed costs that it was rewriting, that led to a very high degree of capital being disrupted. AI, not quite sure what the future holds, but I would say is more likely falls into the bucket of being an enabling technology in the way Microsoft will enable our business to do more efficient analysis. Now, if you look at Google, it's got a pretty hard monopoly in internet search. That is because there are very significant economies of scale to being a dominant search platform. And in my opinion, so just to look through the framework, when we were buying Google shares at $95 a share, 87, whatever it was, Google traded down to call it 15, 16 times earnings. It's got over $100 billion in net cash. It's got operating margins of 30%. If you think about it, this is for a business that has incredible operating leverage, and you could really question what the incremental costs are. And that has grown its top line for over 20% for 20 years. So my assumption would be that Google reverts to a lower level of growth, but has a really robust business in internet search. Margins will rise generally over time. And hence, even on 20 times earnings, if you would think that a fair multiple for this type of business because of its return on capital and because of the competitive advantages it has, you should be making, it doesn't need to reinvest to get there. You should be making something in the high teens percent even from here. So I don't think AI really changes the investment case for Google. If you now look at what's happened in the market, it looks like it probably will increase the value of its cloud business, given that it's one of the few scale providers of that alongside Amazon and Microsoft. And what there is probably some greater risk that Bing is enabled to become a more competitive player to Google Search. However, I think that risk is modest, and there are also upside risks from effectively making a richer search experience.
Yeah. What about Meta? Because obviously that's been through the mill, hasn't it? It's sort of like 18 months ago, everybody hated it. And now it's sort of like turned and it's gone up by about 150, 200% on the back of sort of an efficiency drive, but also now also driving the top line growth.
Yeah, I'll try and be shorter on this otherwise. Meta fell to an extraordinary level, 8 times earnings. And Meta's core business, having 2.5 billion people who use its apps, is very entrenched. The switching costs of leaving Instagram, Facebook are very hard. The network effects from having everyone there are very significant. And what happened was evidently the market really didn't like the investments in the metaverse, which are very significant. I think the company will still burn about $15 billion doing that. Mm. But also the company could become a lot more efficient, because you can imagine what it's like to be in a business that's compounding your revenues at more than 30%, in their case, constantly. So I think actually our primary judgment was just that 8x earnings, you're being valued like a newspaper business. You know, when actually you make 40% margins, I can't see a material threat to your core business. And the fact that it happened within a year of investing was kind of a bonus, and the efficiency drive that's come has meant we sort of underestimated the potential returns, but the judgment we were making was that the risk wasn't justified in the way it was trading. It's a business where you could ask a 12-year-old and they would be able to explain to you what it's about, you know, why it's a robust company.
Yeah, I think it's also another example, isn't it, that the market can just be getting it frankly wrong, that it can drive a share down so far, sentiment can get so poor, but actually it's so severe, you know, this dark before the dawn, so to speak, and then all it needs is a couple of catalysts, and you might well see that in the banks and the other sectors which are beaten down at the moment, that all of a sudden they become less hated, and therefore it starts moving because, to see the stock price of Meta almost triple over an 18-month period is just nuts.
Yeah, and also I think it's, you know, where I think it plays to, which is an interesting one, and I forgot who said this, is it is quite common to have mispricing in large caps because groupthink affects the way, you know, collective behavior in the market is shaped. And therefore sometimes there's loss of perspective, sometimes you're good enough to catch it, sometimes I'm obviously caught in it. It's why these large cap, I think large caps can be mispriced, and you don't have an informational advantage. It's just about behavioral and what you believe really matters to drive the investment.
These passive ETFs have a lot to explain, I think, to a certain extent. Now, moving to Japan, Nintendo, obviously a huge, big global sort of franchise in video games, Super Mario and Pokemon. What sort of like piqued your interest here? How'd you buy a single Japanese stock if you're a retail? I know you're not, but a retail investor, would you have to go through a fund like yours?
I don't know the answer to that because I only have shares in my fund. Otherwise, I would have to explore that. We hold the US line of Nintendo. It's a very large company in Japan, so I suspect you could buy it. I suspect you could buy it like you would any other overseas share. What piqued my interest, this is a funny one. I started in Artemis in 2012, then I got here and I looked at Nintendo and I went, oh my God, it's trading below its cash. I had a 13 billion market cap, we'll get this wrong by a couple of billion, and its cash was 15. And I turned to Will Little, with the person I worked for, and I went, I don't understand this. These are some of the, obviously, I was 21 straight out of the university, but I just went, this is some of the best gaming IP that exists. Mm. And I've always had I've always thought intergenerational affinity is an incredible thing. I watched my mother hog the Mario console when I was 9, and I'll always have a bond with it, and I'll love to take my son to, I'd love for him to play with Mario. So I looked at that and I just couldn't understand it. It, you know, had a negative enterprise value, and I got explained all these sort of rationale. A console had just flopped. It was a Japanese company. It was very conservative. But I just didn't think it made sense. And I worked with Will Littlewood, who's, I think he wouldn't mind me saying this, quite a hardcore value investor. So he was quite easily sold on the fact that this was a great company, and that there wasn't very much downside because it was trading below its cash value. Fast forward, 10 years later, I'm still in it because I am in Artemis Alpha. I should clarify, I've held it since 2016. But for the same reason that the repository of IP this company has is immensely powerful. And what's happened in the last, say, 5-6 years is it's gone from being a largely an analog console company to embracing digital technology. And that's hugely powerful. You can look at the share price chart of EA Sports between 2012 and 2018. Mm. You know, its margins went from 10 to 30. Why? Well, game, the store or electronic boutique, as it was called back in my day, captured a retail margin, which a lot of these developers have internalized, and that's hugely powerful to their business. So in my opinion, Nintendo is going through a similar type of transition. The management are what I would call extremely long-term stewards of the business's IP. So in some senses, they starve the customer. But then if you look at the customer reviews for their games, they're all in the high 90s. They're fantastic. And it's a really unique set of intellectual property, because if you look at it, there's never been a tear of blood shed, a drop of blood shed in a Nintendo game ever. IP. It's the most family-friendly thing in the world. It's also, what's interesting is it should really work in China, whereas, you know, China have pretty strong rules around which games they allow. And I thought there was a fantastic one recently, which is there was a Mario movie released earlier in the year, so they're kind of taking parts of the Disney playbook to extend their IP. So they've built theme parks and they launched their first movie. And I was watching it here and I thought the movie could be quite successful because it is Mario. And it got low 50s in Rotten Tomatoes, i.e. it flopped. It went on to gross $1.4 billion. You know, it's the second most popular animation of all time. And what's funny is you can see critics are sort of slowly, because it's been so successful, the latter critics are actually rating it highly. But what mattered was, you know, the customer actually was so in love with the IP that they didn't need to have a great movie in the critics' eyes, whereas that obviously is a driver of box office sales and many other avenues. So I think it's a fantastic long duration business. It's got $15 billion of net cash, makes $45 billion of operating profit, trades on a low multiple because of some skepticism around the console cycle and if all management, will management sort of do the right thing. But I'm a fan of the business. I think it's a great company.
Yeah, and there's definitely a catch-up trade on the margins if they can carry on driving the sort of the efficiencies and the operational sort of like economies of scale there, particularly if they bring on sort of theme parks and movies and stuff, which should be franchises and should drop straight through to the bottom line. Now, one sector which is significantly undervalued but done quite well, certainly over the last 2 years, not so well this year, is the oil and gas majors. And I see you've got sort of like Shell and BP in there. What's your sort of view for oil and those stocks going forward? Because you've got sort of like a tightness on the supply because OPEC seems to be constraining production capacity. But China has been a bit weak, et cetera, which hasn't helped. Obviously, you know, when it comes to sort of the winter, it's anybody's guess in terms of how cold or warm it's going to be.
So the oil position for us is sort of kind of unlike many of the others. I kind of think of it as, you know, Harry Markowitz wrote Portfolio Selection, which is the book on portfolio management. The reason I find it appealing is it will have a negative correlation to many consumer stocks. We'll probably talk about it, but we have a large position in airlines. And yet I think the return profile looks reasonably attractive. And so the primary reason we have oil in the portfolio is for effectively portfolio reasons, which is that I think, you know, in a long-only construct, oil is probably the best way to hedge some geopolitical risk. Yeah. You know, if there's something that damages LNG distribution, as we saw last year, 4% of the world's gas supply being impacted led to a, you know, multiplying of gas price and switching back on running coal prices. So I think there's geopolitical risk there. And then secondly, you know, our portfolio is a very large consumer of oil. And importantly, as you say, we've come out of a period from a bear market in oil from 2015 and onwards, and what's happened is if you compound that with sort of drive to zero carbon, the cost of capital for oil companies went up materially, and they have not invested as much as you would think that to need to be from a top-down perspective. And so you know, the other observation, which is kind of a simple one to make, is oil consumption is a function of GDP growth and population growth. The world is still growing. Oil demand is actually at a record high. So for all these reasons, I think that those investments look attractive right now, and particularly given the construction of our portfolio, have a valid place in it.
Yeah. No, and also they're just money printing machines, aren't they? And I know I looked at the oil myself when I think when crude hit minus 30, their balance sheets were a bit stretched. So they had a sort of like a net debt to EBITDA of just over two, I think, in certain instances. But now it's about a half. So they've got pristine balance sheets and they're just absolutely printing money. So I'm with you. Sort of less than 8x PE multiple. They look like no-brainers to me. Now, one which is a really sort of controversial sector, got lots of bulls and lots of bears, is the UK house builders. And then you've got quite a few there. You've got Bellway, Barclay Homes, Barratt's, Redrow. We won't go through individually, but just sort of like your view on the house builders. They generally trade at less than tangible book other than Barclay Homes. And you had also a sort of like a trading update from Vistry this morning, which boosted its shares by over 10% and sort of sent the sector up as well. So it could well be that we seem to have reached the bottom of all the selling. But what's your latest view on the UK house builders?
So first observation I'd make is I think value-inclined investors in the UK will usually have a position in house builders. And that is because their businesses are less cyclical than their share prices imply. And the key part to understand there is that in a downturn, and you can look at all the numbers today, house builders generate more cash than they do earnings because of the way you account for land. So that is one of the reasons why I think you'll find value investors as a sort of species will sort of gravitate towards the house builder beehive anytime people fear house prices to fall. That's not my investment case, but it's just an observation. Investment case is kind of simple. If you look at household formation, it's in the region of 250,000. This year, I don't even know what house building will be. It'll probably be close to 100,000, maybe less. And that mismatch between households being formed and houses being built over a decade longer, it equates to about 1 million of undersupply in the UK, 1.2 million. And importantly, that is concentrated in the southeast, so it's not against the whole aggregate supply. And what that means is there's a fundamental demand for housing. If you look at factors, even there are some things that could derail this, like Brexit, and actually UK inward migration reached a record high last year, 600,000. So this demographic is interesting because you've got an accumulated undersupply, and it's very hard to undo because you need housing. It's a basic necessity. So if you can't buy a house, you still need to live in one. So when housing formation is not met like it will be this year and half of last year, the demand is just deferred. It's never lost because someone still needs to live at home. They might be living with their parents, they might be renting, but the demand just doesn't break. And I think that's a very interesting point because it's what underpins the economics of the industry. The second point I would make, which I think is interesting, is if you look at the construct of them, the planning system in the UK is really difficult. That's why you need to hold the land bank. And that's meant that the industry has consolidated perennially over the last 3-4 decades. So that leads to a point which I think most people don't recognize, which is the real, really, really interesting thing about house building is there's no obsolescence risk. There is some chance that Bing is a larger search provider than Google in 10 years. I might think that's very low, but I would have to acknowledge that there's a risk there. Whereas the obsolescence risk to a house builder is zero. I can't see any way to substitute the provision of housing to people. And so I almost feel like these investments are sort of neglected despite having some very low risk characteristics, the demographics, the fact that they're absolutely essential. And so when you strip it back and look at it, they generate good returns through the cycle. When the market is fearful of house prices fall, they derate. The earnings fall, but cash generation doesn't fall as much. And if you look at that today, what does that mean? If you buy a house builder at less than 1x book, my view would be through the cycle returns are in the region of about 15%. And they trade on usually, 15% would be a high return cost of capital. So you should be making really quite compelling prospective returns from here. And that would be my case for all the national house builders. It's slightly different in the case of Barclay Group. That's a bit of a unique business.
Yeah.
But it's why, you could own Vistry, you could Taylor Wimpey. It's a very homogenous investment case across the sector. Vistry is actually slightly different because of its partnerships business. And then the last thing I point out from a portfolio perspective is effectively house builders are beneficiary to a degree on the demand side from interest rates falling. Even though my observation would be over a 10-year period, it won't matter that much because it'll balance out. And obviously something like banks are beneficiaries of interest rates rising or on a fundamental business case. So I'm aware that they have these exposures in the portfolio, but the portfolio has offsetting exposures on other sides.
How solid are the book values for the house builders?
Okay, that's a good one. Pretty solid, because what you need to look if you want to. So I guess what you're saying is, what is the probability of book values falling?
Yeah,
because they fell in 2008. To do that, you need to look at the gross margin embedded in the land bank, and the disclosure across the sector varies here. If you looked at Barrick's last disclosure, which is the most recent to report, not Barclay or Vistry, because they're slightly different, the embedded gross margin, the land bank, was 16%. So even if they sell all their houses today at that price, they're still expecting to make, you know, flat ASPs 16%. So you can imagine you need a very large house price fall to start eating into that gross margin in the land bank, even though do remember from a cash perspective, you've already paid for land. It's not quite that simple because you can imagine that the gross margin distribution in the land bank, you'll have some sites that are 30 and some sites that are 5. So let's say house prices fell another 10%. You probably would start having impairments on the tail end of your land bank. But generally speaking, land is pretty robust. If you look at land prices, they fell after 2008, and they're always effectively a derivative of house prices because that's where the sort of shock absorber is. But you can look at that and see that house prices, land prices never really recovered when house prices recovered. So the gross margins at which house builders have been buying land has been pretty compelling. Another observation I just make, which is why, you know, if you're looking at 2008 and saying, is that the same today? Is it a rerun? Let's first acknowledge the banking sector is in a completely different situation. And secondly, this isn't a mortgage. This isn't a house price led crisis. In fact, actually, sorry, most of the world isn't in a crisis. Importantly, there are two big differences on the structural composition of house builders. One is that they make fewer apartments than they did then. Why does that matter? Is because if you think about it, you can't start selling apartments till they're all built.
Yeah.
You can't just sell one on a site. You've got to build the top floor. So you tie in much more working capital back in 08 than you do today. So it's much harder to release, whereas now you can just release sites on the land. And then secondly, they have a net cash balance sheet across the sector. So, you know, Barclay Group's got, they've all got net cash, significant amount of net cash, which again also insulates you from the balance sheet perspective through a downturn.
And is that net cash an accurate figure given they've got lots of sort of deferred capital creditors?
Yes, it is. So in some cases, you may need to make an adjustment for the land creditors position. Yeah. But yes, actually, it is net cash even after land creditors.
Wow. Okay, which just
to point out to you, is a very conservative position to be in when you own a land bank of homes.
Mm.
You know, the market is, if you look, I think Miller Homes is a private equity house builder with listed debt. And have a look at its leverage compared to the public market sector. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's something like got a 70% LTV, 70% of NAV is geared.
No, I mean, and if you just look at, just observe what the actual house builders are doing, they're paying handsome dividends out, and that's basically because they've got lots of surplus capital. So yeah, I'm with you. They wouldn't be doing that if they thought there was any danger of really sort of like, you know, trashing their dividends. So good income play, a bit like the oil and gas guys. Now, one of the, just turning to consumer, you mentioned it again, you know, must be reasonably positive. Your largest position actually is Frasers, which is the Sports World franchise. Mike Ashley. Now, he's obviously a controversial guy, but has knocked the ball out of the park compared to a lot of retailers over the last 20-odd years. What's your sort of latest on that whole franchise of sort of Sports World, pile them high and sell them sports equipment and athleisure stuff?
Okay, so this business is, so a bit of context here. We've been invested since probably 2016. The share price fell pretty drastically into Brexit, and that was because the company had not hedged its dollar purchases as it did normally, and therefore its gross margins got hit, and that was evidently a mistake. So the share price dropped at 180, today it's £8. And just to explain, the position sizing is sort of having a view of running our winners and assessing opportunity costs and your confidence in the position. And Frasers is one that we remain very confident on. So the size just reflects its price appreciation, not adding to it materially actually since probably 2018.
Well done.
Well, it's, unfortunately, the rest of the portfolio hasn't done that well. That's why the new wife's so large. But it's the way
join the club.
It,
but, join the club.
this business has changed drastically in the last 5 years. Sportsrack was a pilot high, selling cheap business. So if you look at sports, basically a two-player market: JD Sports doing athleisure, Sportsrack doing sporting goods. And it used to have a discounter approach, enabled partly by its ownership of a number of own label brands, Slazenger, Dunlop, Caramore, Everlast. And that was great because it was a value driver to consumers. So you could sell the consumer the £60 Nike trainer, but I'd underpin that with Slazenger, a product that's cheaper, and you could always control the prices because you own the brand. Mike actually built a fantastic business based on that, you know, from one store, and I think 10 grand of savings to 700. In the last 5 years, the business changed significantly. It's moved to being brand-centric on the sports side. Sports side is now making record profits because effectively you can make a lot more gross profit per square foot by selling £200 Nike trainers than you will 60. So, you know, you just, and as you know, Nike's so good at alluring the customer that that is where the customer demand moved. So, you know, it's still the only game in town for sporting goods. And that's a function of retail being so difficult over 20 years and the company being a very good operator. And then it has a luxury business, which, you know, I suspect quite a lot of people don't even know it has. But
no, I didn't even know. What's that called?
It's called Flannels. It's probably got close to $1 billion of turnover. And it's got about 80, it'll have 80 stores at the end of this year. And it is the UK's, I think it's sales, maybe on a neck with Harrods, which is obviously a very large business, you know, business because of one store. But it is the largest omni-channel retailer of luxury goods in the UK.
What type of luxury goods?
£1,800 Moncler jacket down to £2,000 YSL bag, whatever it is. But it's kind of where, if you look, luxury goods have done so well because of demographic change, where effectively younger demographics, I don't know, kids passing their GCSEs want to buy Gucci, enabled by social media. It's catering more to that audience than some of the other sort of, I guess, Harrods type luxury distribution. So it has those two businesses which make up the majority of its earnings today. If you looked in the period, I think it generated close to £1 of free cash flow. It's valued at 8. So it's still quite a lowly valued stock.
Yeah, it's less than 10 times PE.
In my opinion, the really important thing to understand about Frasers is its mindset to capital allocation. So Frasers has this very cash generative beast, this business that generates, call it, 300 to 400 million free cash a year. But what's actually unusual about it is what it does with that money. And now that's probably what catches headlines. So, you know, I can see that the company is in the process to buy Headingley at the moment. It bought Coventry Football Club Stadium. It does some odd things, but it's the mindset behind that, which is effectively what the business has done. And Mike actually has done this for the last 30 years, is it reinvests its capital back into the company. It spent £200 million on automating its warehouse, which is, I think, 42 football pitches big. It's huge. It continues to make acquisitions. Flannels was an acquisition. It's been buying shares in online retailers. It's been buying online retailers where market values have compressed. And it does so to improve the platform that it has to generate more cash. So it's really quite an extraordinary business, but what I think is often misunderstood is just how much it reinvests in itself and how that enables progression in cash flow and earnings. And the last point I'd make to you is, you know, it's the most Mike Ashley owns roughly 70% of the company. The CEO is paid no salary. His only incentive is that he earns £100 million if the share price is £15 by 2025. You can do the maths on what sort of level of earnings that would need to have and then whether that's achievable. But, you know, they are really aligned with shareholders. And I think it's very attractive for that very unique mindset and also the strength of the businesses that it has.
Yeah, I think it's still the go-to provider for sportswear as well. I mean, JD Sport, but I think, I mean, I always go to Sports World because I know what I get and it's a very good price. So yeah, I'm with you. Now, just again, sort of turning tables on the consumer side, just going to airlines, because you touched on it earlier on. Another one, which is a sort of like a statement founder led business that is stepped back now, but EasyJet and to a certain extent Ryanair as well, two very dominant low cost airlines in the UK, but really European, etc. Do you want to take us through your latest views on this one? They must have had an absolute blockbuster time over the summer. I see EasyJet's trading at around about 7.5 times PE, and I'm not sure what Ryanair is, but they must be sailing off into the distance, having had a very tough first year in the pandemic when people were locked down.
So Ryanair's on about 9 times earnings. Ryanair is still a sort of founder-run company. EasyJet isn't. It's got professional management. So we've been invested in the sector since 2018, and it hasn't been it's been a pretty rough ride, but lightly. And the investment chase, I would say, you know, having been disrupted significantly by a pandemic, has improved significantly recently. And you know, to your point, as any casual observer would make, fares have risen markedly. And that's really what's and why that is interesting, and that's why I think these are attractive investments today. And I'm sort of slightly baffled with some of the share price performance recently. If you looked at the profitability transformation of the businesses. So Ryanair did their first capital markets day in 10 years last Monday, and I had a colleague who went to it in Dublin. And what's really interesting is, if you think about it, the demand for travel grows each year. It's a function of demographics, GDP, wealth, population. And if you look at, they estimated that in 2019, there was about a billion of demand, a billion seats worth demand for intra-Europe capacity. And the estimate is that grows about 4% a year. So here we are today, and the estimate is that demand for inter-European travel is about 1.2 billion. And this is where it's very interesting, is because of what the pandemic did to airlines' cash flow and their balance sheet, effectively, and planes depreciate, they just depreciate over time. Capacity this year will only be 900 million. And if you look next year, capacity will probably get up to a billion, but the demand's still growing. So you probably have an undersupply, and I am borrowing Ryanair's estimate for this, of about 200 million seats in European short-haul capacity. Now, why is that important? Is airlines are a commodity business. It's a seat. And therefore, the returns are dictated by the industry structure. And so here you have a situation where there's an undersupply of planes. That is why our prices are rising very sharply, and there's no way to compete with that profit. But really importantly is, you can look at Airbus and Boeing. They're the only two manufacturers of airframes. It's a duopoly, and it is literally impossible to buy new planes. The order books are out to 2030s. Ryanair has a very large order. EasyJet has a reasonable order. Wizz has a large order. But even if you factor in the growth profile that's already there, because Airbus and Boeing couldn't produce planes during the pandemic, because airlines didn't dare order planes during the pandemic, and because demand was just growing anyway, you effectively have a scenario, a very unusual scenario, where the supply dynamics in this sector look very supportive for profitability. And then if you come down a level, Ryanair is a fantastic business. In my opinion, it sort of typifies an anti-fragile company in the way it's managed and the way it's run. And it's trading on 9x earnings. It's usually the price leader, and it's publicly saying that it's going to focus on fare maximization, or fare optimization, I should say. EasyJet has been tougher, and it has made mistakes. But what I point out is, it's the most operation geared in the sector. So this is an interesting stat for you. So EasyJet's PBT estimate for this year is probably 420 million. Its turnover is 9 billion, right? So if airfares were to rise 3% ahead of expectations, that would be 270 million, which drops through to the bottom line. So if you have a view that the sector is set up quite well, which, you know, I think barring some sort of demand-led disaster, I think is, EasyJet's kind of like buying the leverage miner in 2016, which, you know, was Anglo-American, which went from 2 quid a share to 38. So now that was financially leveraged as well as operational leverage. EasyJet is not financially leveraged. But so I can't really explain why the shares have not responded better to what I would actually kind of say is a pretty obvious dynamic now. But I think they're very compelling. And the last point I'd make is, you know, EasyJet owns nearly half the source of Gatwick. It's very hard to compete that away. Ryanair has this cost advantage and this mindset and culture and this scale now that's very hard to compete with. So they're volatile, but I'm slightly disappointed by how they perform. But I think the prospects look good.
Yeah, I mean, another reason for the sort of constrained supply of planes, I think, is because of the Ukraine-Russia war. There was a whole lot of leased aircraft, which are sort of like sitting on runways in Russia, and they're refusing to allow them to back to the West. So I think that took a lot of sort of lease capacity out the market as well for the people who wanted to run the smaller airlines. But even so, yeah, I mean, they've had a blockbuster. The utilization rates, the yields are very high. So yeah, should continue. Now, just getting moving to sort of other financials, and another one which I think is quite a big position in the portfolio, or the ones are a plus 500, Hargreaves Lansdown, and the LSE, and obviously plus let's start quickly with Plus 500. It's one of the UK's sort of main CFD stroke futures operators, and again, hugely cash generative, high margins, seems to be, you know, sponsors, you know, it's well known, isn't it, a lot of the football clubs.
Yeah, so Plus 500 IG CMC, they operate in the provision of effectively CFDs. That, you know, that is a market that's not a million miles away from gambling, so it's really quite different from Hargreaves Lansdown. It does have a utility to consumers. Plus 500 is a very unique organization within that, in my opinion. We've been invested since 2015. I was invested when the shares got suspended, and I was at the AGM when there were accusations of fraud. So I've stuck with them for a very long period of time, and it's been a very good investment. What I think differentiates it is its technology. It's, you know, it is effectively, and I've been to the offices in Tel Aviv. These are, you know, a set of very talented individuals who came out of Technion, which is effectively Israel's equivalent of MIT, to build a technology platform that is very low cost and that is very intelligent with how it digitally markets. And what effectively happens as, like, the whole industry, when volatility goes up, the interest in trading increases significantly, and they harvest that and make significant profits when that happens. They've taken that cash flow and they've globally they've expanded globally into various markets, and they're also, something I think is very interesting, expanding outside of CFDs, which, kind of, as I touched on my first, is, you know, sort of instrument which does have some issues with it in terms of the utility it provides. So whereas futures and other markets is something where they have the technology to provide services, but they haven't been doing it historically. So they've done an acquisition recently, a small one, of a business in the US to do US futures. They're actually now the sponsor of the Chicago Bulls. And I, you know, having watched them for a long period of time, it's a very interesting business in the way it's run. And I think it is competitively advantaged. And the last observation I'd make is they sort of get it with capital allocation. So the business has been trading on a very low multiple. They've shrunk their share count by 30% in the last 5 years. Yeah. So they had one shareholder who was unfortunately forced to sell their shares this year, and they bought back the whole position in one day, 80%. I've never seen a corporate do something like that.
Yeah.
And you know, so I think that's a very interesting business. I point out, from a portfolio perspective, hedging volatility, there's a bit like Markowitz again.
Yeah.
Hedging portfolio volatility is quite attractive. And here is something that gives me a sort of 15% earnings yield. But I also know that, you know, because I've seen it happen to me in the COVID, you know, when the next COVID-like crisis happens, Plus's earnings will increase significantly. So from a portfolio construction standpoint, I also think Plus is attractive. LSC Group's a small position for us. We have it. My colleagues have been very long-term shareholders, and it's done very well for them. But what I think is interesting there is it's done an acquisition of assets called Refinitiv from Blackstone, which kind of push it into being a data services company. Yeah. And it therefore becomes more akin to, like, an S&P and Moody's, which, you know, having a look at the long-term record of them, it's fantastic, where, you know, take an S&P, it's got a data services business, a duopoly in credit rating, and the whole thing feeds on itself. It's a fantastic construct to invest in. Effectively, I think LSE Group is becoming that. And whilst I harbored some concerns, you know, after you do a large acquisition like this from private equity, risk is always elevated. I think it's kind of proven itself so far, and the valuation is reasonably modest on a relative and absolute basis. Hargreaves Lansdown is what I bought recently. And the case is this: is the UK D2C market is 200 billion of assets. Hargreaves has about 100, and sorry, it's Hargreaves is 40% of the market, so it must be 300 billion. Hargreaves is 130 billion of that, so it's got dominant share. And the UK D2C overall asset pool is a fraction of 8 trillion of financial assets. So, in my opinion, in 20 years' time, the proportion of UK households that should be engaging in managing their own financial assets should rise significantly. Household wealth will rise anyway. The UK has a disproportionate amount in housing stock. And for all those reasons, I think it's an attractive growth market. Hargreaves has gone from trading on 28 times earnings to 10, even though its earnings have actually risen. Now, why has that happened? Is it reflects, I think, concerns over structural obsolescence. You know, maybe Vanguard will be 40% of the market in 5 years' time. Maybe it'll be Apple. I don't know. But from what I can see, those concerns are in my opinion, likely to be misplaced. I think it provides very good service. I use it. I don't get charged for holding an investment trust in it, so my fees are extremely low. It's great service. My mother-in-law uses it because she needs, you know, the phone. And in the investment market, there's an emphasis on, is it overcharging the customer? Because on a headline basis, the platform fees are slightly higher. I think that's simplistic when you look at the mix and when you look at the service provided. I also, in my estimates, assume that fees will come down over time as it grows scale. But so it's valued at $3 billion, it's 10 times earnings today, has more than $500 million in net cash. Mm. Its churn ratio, you know, customer retention is 92%. If you remove debts, it'd probably be closer to 100. So I think it's I think it's a very attractive business, not without risk. And a new CEO is coming in, and we'll see what he says.
Yeah, I think the main sort of is a short term concern on Hargreaves Lansdown. It's because obviously it serves sort of active investors, and most active investors have been battered this last 2 years, and therefore it's sort of like a thought that that will reduce the amount of revenue they get from customers if they just go quiet and not do anything. And I know there's a lot of ones I speak to are sort of like permanent depression at the moment, but that's a short-term temporary issue if it is that one. Now, just quickly moving to healthcare, you've got GSK and Haleon, really the sort of the two sides of the same coin, given the spin-off from of Haleon from GSK. GSK has been a huge underperformer for years and years and years, largely back on really, you know, due to fears over the quality of its research, its cancer research. It's sold off. Now it's getting back in, but obviously got the vaccine side of it. So I don't know if you want to take us through your latest thoughts on GSK. You might find that Emma Walmsley ringing you up just before you speak to her.
it's effectively got three different businesses. It's got vaccines, ViiV, which is HIV, and then a general pharmaceuticals business. And it previously had consumer health, which is spun off. If you look at the business, and I've been sort of watching it for 6-7 years, it's improved the way, effectively it also had debt and it had a high dividend, so it wasn't really able to invest in R&D. But if you look at the vaccines business in particular, it really is kind of a world-class leading player, particularly in vaccines for virus. So, you know, you could note that it's actually very disappointing that GSK never came up with a drug, with a vaccine for COVID.
Yeah, I know.
Right? And you know, you say, well, you hold the world's largest vaccine maker, and it didn't even have a candidate, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, Moderna signified some sort of disruption. Right. Because
mRNA technology seemed to blow the whole sort of like traditional vaccine technology out the water.
Now, in my opinion, and from the work I've done, it might be misplaced in the long term. From what I can understand is mRNA technology is particularly relevant to certain forms of viruses like cold, like coronavirus, but it may not have the same efficacy as some of the more traditional style vaccines have in some of these longer term viruses that you get, shingles being the primary example, where Glaxo's vaccine has a 98% efficacy. So your vaccines business is world-class. Your HIV business is a duopoly with Gilead, where there's some concerns over the 2028 patent cliff. And then you have this business of general pharmaceuticals, which is permanently being replenished. Today, the business trades on 9x earnings. Mm. And if you look in the future, the pipeline replenishment that is reasonably visible because it's already happened should lead to quite significant and earnings growth, certainly out to 2028. Question is then what happens in 2028, because effectively a large proportion of ViiV comes off patent. And the market has derated the business from this. I'll sort of go to an old saying, which will literally say to me, is always buy a pharma business when the market doesn't believe it has a pipeline, right? Because effectively the pipeline is always
I agree.
And the value oscillates. So if you look today, if you're paying 9x earnings with Glaxo, you're not paying for the pipeline anyway. Even though from all the disclosure I can see and understand, the pipeline looks like it has some bets that could come right. So for that reason, given its balance sheet, given its earnings profile, and also given some of the internal change, so if you looked within GSK, there are a number of people who have joined from AstraZeneca, most notable being Luke Mills. You can kind of look at the performance recently on an operational basis and see some momentum there. So, you know, the company has beat earnings for, I think, the last six, 7 quarters. So GSK, in my opinion, also, I mean, it's pharmaceuticals, it's acyclical industry. I think it's an attractive investment. I think it's sort of, you know, it has the potential to surprise also because the rating is so low. So, you know, if we looked at a case study of why has AstraZeneca been so successful, right? A lot of it would come from the low valuation it started at. Now then, you know, Sorio turned it into a much better company. It had great success in oncology, and the shareholder return has been incredible. But I would argue, unless I'm misjudging some of the risks in Glaxo, that the potential from here looks really quite compelling. And you don't need that much right to happen when a business with its characteristics is trading on 9x earnings.
Yeah, I'll have to have a look.
Haleon's a spin-off from GSK, owns a bunch of consumer staples. We had our spin-off shares, and then the share price fell from 320 to 250 in August 2022 because of these concerns around Zantac. And so we increased our position. We've now got a material position in Haleon, so we have 4% of GSK, 3% in Haleon. Haleon, I think, is a really fantastic consumer staples business. It's, you know, you look at Sensodyne. Sensodyne's compounded at extremely high return rates over the last 10, 20 years, and it occupies this niche for sensitivity and a bit of premiumization in toothpaste. And if you look across the portfolio, it effectively has a number of brands that sit in these niches where they are dominant. And you know, it is effectively an inflation-linked cash flow, I would argue. I mean, it's seeking to grow at 4-6% a year. I think it would do better. So if you combine an asset which is on 15x earnings, that's what? An earnings yield of nearly 6, which is inflation linked. Well, I'd much rather have that than a real index linked bond. And so I think Haleon has lots of potential. It also has potential in things like Rx OTC switches. So this is where you switch something from being prescription only to being over the counter.
Yeah.
That is a big growth driver for the types of businesses, the types of products that Haleon sells. And it's got two in the pipeline, which if they were to come through, it would be material. And then the last thing is this sector could consolidate significantly. So Haleon is the largest personal care business in the world. I think about our health and personal care business in the world. And there are a number of assets which potentially you could combine together, which would lead to significant operational synergies. Mm. Because if you imagine if Boots is your customer, you can literally go in and then look at the shelf in pain, and you see Reckitt's and you see GSK and then in vitamins. Similarly, it's quite fragmented, and there'd be a lot of synergies in putting together these brands, which I think is one of the long-term objectives there. So it's a portion of the portfolio which has different drivers to others, but I like characteristics and I like valuation.
Mm. They've got quite a big heavy debt mountain though, haven't they? In terms of that'll obviously increase their interest cost.
So they're hedged on a good proportion of their interest costs. Their interest costs are about 300 million. If you think operating profit, I think is 2 billion. So
right.
The interest is partly hedged, and it's okay. You're right to point out that there is a lot of debt. 3x net debt is much higher than the sector average, but it is a very cash generative business.
Fine.
Your CapEx requirements are pretty low.
Okay, just the last sector, just to have a quick touch on, is online food delivery. And I see you've got Delivery Hero in the top 10 positions, and likewise, you've got Just Eat there. What sort of attracted you to there? Because they were pandemic darlings, but obviously, you know, there's been a less need now for delivery services as people decide to go out to restaurants.
So perhaps just to observe, so I've held Delivery Hero since 2017 at its IPO. I bought it at 25 euros, had 100,000 shares, I think, peak. I think today we've got 160,000 shares because I bought more on the way down. And that share price went to 140, and it's currently 31, yeah. Right? And Just Eat bought in 2018, went up a long way, and it's been a very poor investment since then. So just wanting to be upfront about it, I've held them way before they're unfashionable, and now that they're unfashionable, and they're evidently in the category of mistakes. But I'll explain why I'm holding on to them and why I think they might not be as bad in the States as the market currently is telling me they are. So I just make a very simple observation. I live in London, and if you live in an urban area, technology changed the way restaurants can communicate with customers, and online food delivery, both through the restaurant sending you the food or a delivery done by the service, by Deliveroo, Parcel London, or Just Eat, I think was a pretty significant innovation. because effectively you can get restaurant quality food from, I don't know, 4,000 restaurants faster than you would do get room service in a hotel, right? Now, I think that's quite a significant technological change. It's moved into grocery. And when you have a change like this, it's a bit like online streaming. You get an S-curve where adoption accelerates, happens very quickly, but it happens slowly over time. And, you know, I could ask you how many times you order online food, but I think when your kids are your age, they'll do it with you, right? So part of this is it's demographic behavior that is slow to enact. But so my starting point would be that I think there's a lot of value in these services. If you look at China, Meituan is a very successful business there, and it's got and I haven't checked the market cap recently, but it was I think around $60-80 billion, right? So there is a playbook here, and there is a value for these services. And my observation would be that we are in the reasonably early stages of its application, and therefore I think these will be growing businesses. Now, I think as Peter Lynch said, growing businesses don't always make good investments. That's what I've learned the hard way, because of A, capital cycle, and B, the pandemic led to such significant growth that the demands of that made these businesses operationally inefficient. Mm. And in my judgment, which we'll wait and see, I think two things will happen is the growth rates will come back, whereas currently they look like they're shrinking. Secondly, that these businesses can be very profitable because of their fundamental characteristics, in the sense that there are local economies of scale, there are ways to become profitable, so advertising revenue, which, you know, transformed the Amazon e-commerce business, I think is relevant to a business like Delivery Hero. So Delivery Hero is valued at $8 billion. If you look at DoorDash, it's valued at $30 billion. If you look, it's just the leading player in the US. If you look at Meituan, don't have it in front of me, but it's, I think, well north of $50 billion. It serves an enormous population where the service is very popular and where it is market leader. And so really, we'll see. I'm looking very wrong today, but my judgment is that penetration will continue to rise over time and profitability will too, in which case they could become very good investments.
Yeah, I mean, market psychology, as we talked about earlier on, you know, with Meta and Facebook, I mean, it just goes in cycles, doesn't it? It gets extreme at both ends. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think more people are going to be doing online food delivery. There's no doubt about it going forward than less.
The only thing I'd point out is, like, I mean, there have been elements here which have been wrong, right? In terms of, you know, the barriers to entry were lower than I first judged, etc. And therefore, it's not quite like a, you know, Meta just falling 70% because Mark Zuckerberg invests in the metaverse and advertise, you know, Apple hurts its top line. It's slightly different, but it's always, you know, when you're in the middle of a mistake, it's always quite hard to work out what's right, you know, which part you've quite got wrong, which is why I think it's often useful to think about what stage of the mistake you're in.
Yeah. Well, I make lots of mistakes and I know other investors do. So, and I think you probably make much fewer than everybody else. So anyway, thanks very much, Kartik, for taking us through your insights and lots of excellent stock ideas that people can research and go away. And if somebody wants to invest in the your Artemis funds, how best to do that?
So I run Artemis Alpha Trust, which is an investment trust listed on the stock exchange, and you can buy that through any online platform. I also run the Artemis European Fundamental Equity product, which is XUK, and that's an open-ended unit. So again, you can invest in that through platforms. Today, we primarily focused on the composition of the UK fund.
Brilliant. Okay, well, great. Well, look forward in hearing your thoughts in about 6 months' time. So thanks very much, Kartik.
Thank you.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.